Eleanor had promised herself she would not cry. The stone walls of St. Margaret's Church held the June heat like a kiln, and the scent of wilting lilies pressed against her senses until she felt she might suffocate. She stood among the bridesmaids, her hands folded so tightly around the wilting posy of white roses that the thorns bit into her palms through her gloves. The pain was a small, sharp mercy, something to anchor her, something to keep her tethered to the pews, the stained glass, the murmur of 400 guests, rather than the abyss yawning open beneath her ribs. The organ swelled. The congregation rose. Lady Beatrice Montford glided down the aisle on her father's arm, a confection of Brussels lace and seed pearls, her golden hair piled high beneath a diamond tiara that caught the candlelight and flung it across the nave like scattered sovereigns. She was everything a future duchess should be, poised, radiant, utterly untouched by doubt. And Eleanor, her poor cousin, her quiet shadow, her necessary extra bridesmaid to balance the numbers, stood at the altar rail and felt the world crumbling to dust. She had met the Duke of Ashworth only once before. A country ball 18 months ago in the assembly rooms at Harrogate, she had been visiting her aunt, a last kindness before her father's debts had swallowed the last of their respectability. The Duke had danced with her precisely once, a quadrille during which she had been so tongue-tied she had managed only, "Yes, Your Grace," and "No, Your Grace," and "The weather is very fine, Your Grace." He had smiled, a quiet, weary smile that did not reach his gray eyes, and she had been lost, hopelessly, irrevocably lost. And now he was marrying her cousin. Eleanor lifted her chin. She would not cry. She would not disgrace herself. She would stand through this ceremony like a soldier on a battlefield, and then she would return to her narrow bed in her uncle's London house, and she would pack her meager belongings, and she would find a position as a governess or a companion, and she would forget she had ever seen the Duke of Ashworth's face. The Archbishop began the opening prayers. Eleanor's gaze, against her will, drifted to the groom. He stood tall and still at the altar, his profile sharp as a cut silhouette against the glow of the candles. His dark hair was brushed back from a high forehead, his jaw set with a tension that had nothing to do with nerves and everything to do with endurance. He was not looking at his bride. He was looking at Eleanor. Their eyes met across the marble floor, across the lilies, across the great chasm of impossibility that separated a duke from a penniless cousin. His gaze was steady, searching, as though he were trying to read something written in a language he barely understood. Eleanor felt her heart stutter and stop. A tear, the one she had sworn she would not shed, slipped free and traced a burning path down her cheek. She looked away. She bit the inside of her lip until she tasted copper, and when she dared to glance back, he was still watching her, his face unreadable, his gray eyes dark with something that might have been recognition, or might have been pity, or might have been the same silent, hopeless longing that was devouring her from within. The Archbishop asked the bride to repeat her vows. Lady Beatrice's voice rang out clear and confident. The Duke's responses were low, measured, toneless. Eleanor hid her tears at the wedding, unaware that the groom was watching her, not the bride. 3 years later, the letter arrived on a Tuesday morning, carried by a liveried footman who looked supremely uncomfortable standing in the muddy yard of Mrs. Haverhill, seminary for young ladies, where Eleanor had been employed as junior governess for the past 18 months. She was in the schoolroom, drilling the Haverhill twins on their French irregular verbs, when the housekeeper tapped at the door and handed her a sealed envelope of heavy cream paper. The wax bore the imprint of a coronet and a falcon, the Ashworth crest. Eleanor's fingers trembled so violently that she nearly dropped it. Miss Eleanor Prescott was written on the front in a hand she did not recognize. She broke the seal and unfolded the single sheet within. "Miss Prescott, I write on behalf of His Grace, the Duke of Ashworth, who requests the honor of your presence at Thornwood Hall at your earliest convenience to discuss a matter of mutual benefit. A carriage will await you at Harrogate Station upon receipt of your reply. I remain, madam, your obedient servant, J. Thorne, steward to His Grace. Alina read the letter 3 times. A matter of mutual benefit. What possible matter could exist between a duke and a governess who had not exchanged a single word in 3 years? She should refuse. She should write a polite note declining the invitation and remain here, safe among the French verbs and the chalk dust and the carefully contained expectations of her small, narrow life. Instead, she found herself at Harrogate Station 2 days later, climbing into an Ashworth carriage with her single valise and a heart full of questions she was terrified to answer. Thornwood Hall rose from the North Yorkshire moorland like a great stone beast fallen into a long and troubled sleep. The drive wound through an avenue of ancient oaks whose branches had not been trimmed in a decade, and the lawns that had once rolled green and immaculate to the ha-ha were now a wilderness of overgrown hedges and meadowsweet. The house itself was a Jacobean manor of honey-colored stone, its mullioned windows catching the gray light like half-closed eyes. Alina stepped down from the carriage and felt the silence of the place settle over her like a shroud. No dogs barked. No servants bustled. The only sound was the wind sighing through the broken weather vane atop the stable block. The great oak door swung open before she could reach for the knocker. A gray-haired woman in housekeeper's black stood in the threshold, her face worn but kind. "Miss Prescott, I am Mrs. Croft. His Grace is waiting for you in the library. Please follow me." The hall was cavernous and cold, its paneled walls hung with portraits shrouded in dust sheets. Alina's footsteps echoed on the flagstones as she followed Mrs. Croft through a succession of dim corridors until they reached a heavy door at the end of the east wing. "In here, miss," Mrs. Croft said softly and withdrew. Alina pushed open the door. The library smelled of old leather and wood smoke and something sharper, brandy, perhaps, or grief. Shelves rose to the ceiling on 3 walls, crammed with books that appeared untouched for years. A fire guttered in the massive stone hearth, casting flickering shadows across the Turkey carpet. And there, standing before the window with his back to her, was the Duke of Ashworth. He turned. Alina had braced herself for the sight of him. She had told herself, 100 times on the journey north, that she was no longer a foolish girl of 19, that her heart had long since learned its lesson, that the Duke was nothing to her now but a memory of a dance and a wedding and a tear she should never have shed. She had been wrong on every count. 3 years had carved new lines into his face, grooves beside his mouth, shadows beneath his eyes, but the eyes themselves were the same gray, the same steady gaze that had pierced her across the altar. He was thinner than she remembered, his shoulders carrying a weight that had nothing to do with the cut of his coat. "Miss Prescott," he said. His voice was deeper, rougher, as though it had been scraped raw and never quite healed. "Thank you for coming." "Your Grace," she curtsied, and the gesture felt absurdly formal, a relic of a world she no longer belonged to. "Please sit." She lowered herself into a chair near the fire. He did not sit. Instead, he stood before the hearth, one hand braced against the mantel, staring into the flames as though searching for something he had lost there long ago. "My wife is dead," he said without preamble. "She died 3 months after our daughter was born, a riding accident, she was." He stopped, swallowed. "She was headstrong, reckless. I should never have let her ride that day. We had quarreled, and I said things I cannot unsay, and she rode out alone in a storm to punish me. They found her in the ravine at dawn." Alina's heart clenched. "I am so very sorry, Your Grace." He made a sharp gesture, cutting off her sympathy. "The child survived, Charlotte. She is 2 years old now, and she is the only good thing that came from that marriage. But my wife's family, the Montfords, believe I am unfit to raise her. They have petitioned the courts to remove Charlotte from my custody. They claim I neglected Beatrice, that my estate is falling to ruin, that my grief has made me incapable of caring for a child." He turned at last to face her. and his expression was stripped of all pretense. They are not entirely wrong. Thornwood is crumbling. I have no mistress to manage the household, no mother to care for Charlotte. If the court rules against me, I will lose my daughter. That is why I asked you here. Eleanor's breath caught. I do not understand. I need a wife, he said, with the same flat precision he might have used to discuss a livestock purchase. I need a woman of character, of intelligence, of discretion. I remember you, Miss Prescott. I remember the day of my wedding, and I remember the look on your face when you thought no one was watching. Heat flooded Eleanor's cheeks. She opened her mouth to deny it, to explain, but he raised a hand. You need not explain yourself. I saw genuine feeling that day, the only genuine feeling in that entire church, I suspect. It stayed with me. When I learned you were still unmarried, working as a governess, I knew you were the person I needed. You are proposing marriage, Eleanor whispered, the words feeling foreign on her tongue. A marriage of convenience. I offer you a home, security, a position as Duchess of Ashworth and mother to my child. I ask in return that you manage my household, care for my daughter, and help me demonstrate to the courts that Thornwood is a fit home for a child. There will be no expectation of, he hesitated, of anything beyond a partnership. You will have your own apartments, your own income. I will not trouble you. She should have been relieved by his coldness. It made the arrangement clean, practical, safe. But something inside her, that foolish 19-year-old who had wept at his wedding, felt the words like a blade between her ribs. And love, she asked, before she could stop herself. Is there to be no expectation of that either? His expression did not change. I loved my first wife, or believed I did. It brought me nothing but guilt and grief and a daughter who may yet be taken from me. I have nothing left to give in that regard, Miss Prescott. If you require love, you must look elsewhere. The silence stretched between them, filled only by the crackle of the dying fire. Eleanor looked at this man, this broken, grieving, desperate man, and felt something shift inside her chest. He was not the same Duke who had danced with her in Harrogate. He was scarred, hollowed out, a house with all the windows boarded. But she had loved him then, and some stubborn, unkillable part of her loved him still. Very well, she said, I accept. They were married by special license 4 days later in the village church at Thornwood Parva, with only Mrs. Croft and the vicar's wife as witnesses. Eleanor wore her best gray merino dress, because there had been no time to procure anything finer, and the Duke wore black, because he always wore black now. The vicar pronounced them man and wife, and the Duke touched her hand for precisely the briefest moment required by ceremony, and then it was done. She was the Duchess of Ashworth. She did not feel like a duchess. She felt like an intruder. The first weeks at Thornwood were a trial by ice. The Duke, Alexander, she supposed she must call him now, though she could not bring herself to speak his name aloud, withdrew into his study immediately after the ceremony and remained there for 3 days. Eleanor explored the house alone, her footsteps echoing through rooms that had not known a woman's touch since the late Duchess's death. The nursery was on the third floor, tucked beneath the eaves at the end of a long, drafty corridor. Eleanor pushed open the door and felt her heart break. The room was cold. The fire had been allowed to burn out, and the windows were filmed with grime. In a battered crib near the far wall, a small child lay swaddled in blankets that were clean but threadbare, her dark curls matted against her forehead, her cheeks pale and tear-streaked. An elderly nursemaid dozed in a rocking chair in the corner, her chin resting on her chest, a half-empty bottle of gin on the table beside her. Eleanor dismissed the nursemaid on the spot, overriding the woman's bleary protests with a quiet authority that surprised even herself. Then she knelt beside the crib and lifted the child, Charlotte, Lottie, into her arms. The little girl stirred, her gray eyes, her father's eyes, blinking open. She did not cry. She simply stared up at Eleanor with a wariness that no 2-year-old should possess. Hello, sweetheart, Eleanor whispered and her throat tightened. I am Eleanor, and I promise you from this moment onward you will never be cold again. Lottie's small hand closed around Eleanor's finger. It was the first warmth she had felt since arriving at Thornwood. The first real confrontation came a fortnight after the wedding. Eleanor had spent those 2 weeks working from dawn until midnight, scrubbing the nursery herself when the remaining servants proved insufficient, ordering new linens from the village, replanting the kitchen garden that had gone to seed, and reviewing the household accounts with Mr. Thorne, the steward, whose pinched expression suggested he resented the intrusion. The accounts were a disaster. Eleanor sat at the desk in the morning room that she had claimed as her own, a ledger spread open before her, and traced the columns of figures with a growing sense of dread. Payments to suppliers that could not be accounted for, wages drawn for servants who did not exist, a steady, systematic bleeding of funds that had been going on for at least 2 years, since before the late Duchess's death. She found Alexander in the library that evening, staring into the fire with a glass of brandy untouched at his elbow. "We must speak," she said, closing the door behind her. He did not look up. "Must we?" "Yes," she crossed to the desk and laid the ledger before him. "Your steward is stealing from you." That got his attention. His gray eyes sharpened and he reached for the book, scanning the pages she had marked. His jaw tightened. "This is a serious accusation." "It is a serious crime. Mr. Thorne has been falsifying the accounts for at least 2 years. I have found discrepancies in the butcher's bills, the coal deliveries, the wages register. There are servants on this payroll who have never set foot in Thornwood. I estimate the losses at nearly £2,000. He stared at her, and for the first time she saw something other than weariness in his expression, a flicker of interest, perhaps even respect. "You have been thorough." "I was raised in a household that was slowly starving for want of money, Your Grace. I learned to read a ledger before I learned to embroider a cushion." He set the book aside and rose to his feet. For a long moment, he simply looked at her, as though seeing her properly for the first time since her arrival. "I will dismiss Thorne tomorrow," he said at last. "Thank you." It was not an apology. It was not an admission that he had been wrong to leave her alone, to ignore her, to treat her as a piece of furniture he had acquired to fill an empty space. But it was something, a crack in the wall he had built around himself, a sliver of light through the stone. Eleanor took it and held it close to her heart, and hoped it would be enough. The days began to find a rhythm. Eleanor rose at dawn and took Lottie into the garden while the dew was still on the grass. She taught the little girl the names of flowers, foxglove, harebell, meadowsweet, and watched as the child's pallid cheeks slowly bloomed with color. She hired new servants from the village, decent, hardworking folk who had been loyal to the Ashworth estate for generations, and dismissed the ghosts of the old regime. She coaxed the housekeeper, Mrs. Croft, into an alliance, and between them they began the slow work of scrubbing the neglect from Thornwood's bones. Alexander remained distant but not entirely absent. He appeared at dinner now, seated at the opposite end of the long mahogany table, and they conversed in careful, measured sentences about the estate, the weather, the progress of the repairs. He did not speak of Beatrice. He did not speak of his grief. He did not touch her, not even by accident, not even the brush of a hand passing the salt. But sometimes, when she was reading to Lottie in the nursery, Eleanor would glance up and find him standing in the doorway, watching them with an expression she could not decipher. He never stayed long, he never said a word, but he came, again and again, drawn by some gravitational pull he seemed unable to resist. She began to hope. Foolishly, recklessly, against all the evidence of her reason, she began to hope. And then he told her he was leaving for London. "The court hearing has been scheduled for the 23rd of next month," he said, standing before her in the morning room with his traveling coat already buttoned and his hat in his hand. "I must meet with my barrister and prepare our case. Lord Montfort has engaged one of the finest legal minds in England. I cannot afford to be unprepared. Eleanor's heart plummeted. How long will you be gone? 3 weeks, perhaps four. And what am I to do while you are away? He hesitated. For a moment, his mask slipped, and she glimpsed the exhaustion beneath, the bone-deep weariness of a man who had been fighting alone for so long that he had forgotten how to ask for help. Keep my daughter safe, he said quietly. Keep my house standing. That is all I ask. He turned to go. Alexander. The name stopped him in his tracks. He did not turn around, but his shoulders tensed, and she saw his grip tighten on the brim of his hat. Come back, she said, her voice barely above a whisper. Please, whatever happens in London, come back. He stood motionless for a long, agonizing moment. Then, without a word, without a backward glance, he walked out of the room, out of the house, and into the waiting carriage. Eleanor watched from the window as the coach rolled down the drive and disappeared into the mist that was rolling in from the moors. She did not cry. She had learned long ago to hide her tears. But her heart ached with a loneliness so profound she thought it might crush her. The long weeks. Lord Henry Montfort arrived on a Thursday, 2 weeks after Alexander's departure, without warning and without an invitation. Eleanor was in the kitchen garden, helping Lottie plant a row of carrots, the child's small fingers patting the soil with intense concentration, when Mrs. Croft came hurrying down the path, her face pale. Your Grace, Lord Montfort, is here. He's in the drawing room. He insists on seeing Lady Charlotte. Eleanor's blood turned to ice. She lifted Lottie into her arms, ignoring the child's protest at being separated from her mud, and handed her to the young nursery maid who had become her trusted right hand. Take her to the nursery and lock the door, she said quietly. Do not open it for anyone but me. Do you understand, anyone? The girl nodded, her eyes wide, and hurried away with the child. Eleanor smoothed her hair, brushed the soil from her apron, and walked into the house with her head held high and her heart hammering against her ribs. Lord Henry Montfort was tall, fair-haired, and dressed in a coat of superfine blue that had never seen a moment's honest wear. He stood before the empty hearth, tapping his riding crop against his polished boot, and when Eleanor entered, he did not bow. He merely looked at her, assessed her, and smiled a smile that did not reach his cold blue eyes. So, he said, you are the new Duchess, my late sister's replacement. I am the Duchess of Ashworth, yes. Eleanor's voice was steady, though her hands trembled. To what do we owe the pleasure of this visit, my lord? I have come to see my niece. I have that right. You have no right to enter this house uninvited and demand to see a child whose father is not present. If you wish to visit Lady Charlotte, you may write to His Grace and request an appointment. Lord Montfort's smile thinned. His Grace is in London, I understand, attempting to salvage a case he has already lost. The courts will rule in my favor. The child will be placed in my custody. It is only a matter of time. Then you may wait until that time arrives. Until then, this is my home, and Lady Charlotte is under my protection. I must ask you to leave. He stepped closer, and Eleanor forced herself not to retreat. He was taller than her by nearly a head, and there was something predatory in the way he moved, a coiled menace beneath the polished veneer. You are very brave, he murmured, for a woman who was a governess 6 months ago. Do you imagine you can stand against me? Do you imagine you can protect that crumbling pile of stones and a broken duke and a child who is not even yours? I imagine a great many things, my lord. Eleanor met his gaze and did not blink. But I do not imagine I am alone. The tenants of this estate, the servants in this house, the village that depends upon Ashworth, they have all seen what you and your family did to Thornwood. They have all seen the accounts, the falsified records, the years of embezzlement that bled this estate dry while the late Duchess looked the other way. I have sent copies of those ledgers to His Grace's barrister in London. The court will see them, and the court will see you for what you are. For a single, breathless instant, Lord Montfort's mask slipped. Elinor saw fury flash in his eyes, raw, unguarded, dangerous fury, before he mastered it and stepped back, his smile returning like a blade sliding back into its sheath. "You have made a grave mistake," he said softly. "I do not forget insults, Your Grace, and I do not forgive them." He turned on his heel and strode from the room. A moment later, she heard the front door slam and the sound of hooves thundering down the drive. Elinor sank into the nearest chair, her legs giving way beneath her. She was shaking, every nerve in her body alight with terror and exhilaration. She had done it. She had stood her ground. But she knew, with a cold certainty that settled into her bones, that this was not over. Lord Montford was not a man who accepted defeat. He would return, and next time, he would not come alone. Alexander came home on the last day of the month, riding through the gates just as the autumn dusk was settling over the moors like a purple shroud. Elinor heard the hoofbeats from the morning room and ran to the window, her heart leaping into her throat. She saw him dismount, coat travel-stained, face unshaven, eyes hollow with exhaustion, and before she knew what she was doing, she was flying down the front steps, her skirts tangling around her ankles, her carefully maintained composure shattering into a thousand pieces. "Alexander." He turned at the sound of her voice, and for a moment, neither of them moved. The space between them was charged with something electric, something unspoken, something that had been building for months in the silence and the distance, and the stolen glances across the nursery threshold. Then he walked toward her, his stride quickening, and caught her hands in his. "I came as soon as I could," he said, his voice rough. "The barrister told me what you found. The ledgers, the false accounts, it implicates Montford directly. He has been stealing from the estate for years, using Beatrice as his instrument. The court will dismiss his petition now. He has no grounds." "He was here," Elinor said, 2 weeks ago. He came to the house demanding to see Lottie. I refused." Alexander's grip on her hands tightened. "He came here. He threatened you." "I am unharmed. But he was angry, Alexander. He said he does not forgive." Something shifted in his face, a darkness, a protective fury that she had never seen before. He released her hands and strode into the house, barking orders for the servants to double the watch, to lock the gates, to admit no one without his express permission. And when he returned to the drawing room an hour later, washed and changed but still hollow-eyed, he found Elinor waiting for him with a tray of tea and a fire blazing in the hearth. "Tell me everything," she said quietly. "Tell me what happened in London." He sank into the chair opposite hers, and for the first time since their wedding night, he talked to her. Not in measured, careful sentences, but in a flood. The lawyers, the depositions, the late Duchess's maid who had come forward with evidence of Montford's embezzlement, the long nights alone in his London townhouse haunted by memories of Beatrice and guilt, and the daughter he was terrified of losing. "I should have listened to you sooner," he said at last, his voice barely audible above the crackle of the fire. "I should have trusted you. Instead, I locked myself away and left you to fight my battles alone." "You were grieving." "I was hiding. There is a difference." He lifted his eyes to hers, and the vulnerability she saw there made her heart ache. "You have saved my daughter's future. You have saved my home. I do not know how to repay you." "You do not need to repay me," Elinor said softly. "I am your wife." The words hung in the air between them, heavy with meaning neither of them had dared to acknowledge. Alexander looked at her, really looked at her, and Elinor felt the wall he had built around himself begin to crack, stone by stone. "Yes," he said, "you are." It was not a declaration of love, it was not a confession, but it was a beginning. The custody hearing was held in the High Court of Chancery on a cold November morning, and it lasted 3 days. Elinor sat in the gallery every day, her hands folded in her lap, her back straight, her face calm, while inside her heart was a storm. Lord Montford's barrister was, as promised, formidable. He painted Alexander as a negligent husband, a distant father, a man consumed by grief and guilt and incapable of providing a stable home. He called witnesses, servants dismissed by a leaner, the old nursemaid with her gin bottle, a village gossip who claimed to have seen the Duke riding recklessly across the moors in the dead of night. But Elena had done her work. When the Ashworth barrister rose, he produced the falsified ledgers, the testimony of the former steward Mr. Thorne, who had confessed to the embezzlement in exchange for leniency, and a sworn statement from the late Duchess's ladies made detailing years of neglect and cruelty from Lord Montfort and his sister. He called Mrs. Croft, who spoke of the new Duchess's kindness, her tireless work to restore the estate, her devotion to the child. He called the vicar of Thornwood Parva, who testified that Lady Charlotte was thriving, healthy, happy, loved. And then he called Elena. She walked to the witness box on legs that felt made of water. The courtroom was vast and echoing, filled with faces she did not know, and the Lord Chancellor himself presided from his high bench, his expression unreadable. She swore the oath and folded her trembling hands on the rail. The barrister's questions were gentle, coaxing. She answered them simply, honestly. Yes, she had come to Thornwood as a stranger. Yes, the house had been in disrepair. Yes, she had worked to restore it. Yes, she loved Charlotte as though she were her own. And then Lord Montfort's barrister rose for cross-examination. "Your Grace," he began, his voice smooth as silk, "is it not true that you married the Duke of Ashworth for his money and his title, having been nothing more than a penniless governess before your advantageous match?" Elena's heart hammered, but she lifted her chin. "I married the Duke because he asked me. I married him to give his daughter a mother and his home a mistress. I brought no fortune, no connections, no advantage of any kind. If the match was advantageous, it was advantageous to me, not to him. And yet you expect this court to believe that your motives were entirely altruistic, that you have no desire for the wealth and status your position affords you." "I expect this court to believe the evidence of its own eyes," Elena said, her voice steady now. "Look at the accounts. Look at the testimony of the servants, the tenants, the villagers. Look at the child. I did not marry the Duke for money, my lord. I married him because I believed in him. Because I believed he deserved a chance to be the father Charlotte needed. Because I believed Thornwood was worth saving." She paused and then she said very quietly, "Because I loved him." The words slipped out before she could stop them. She felt the blood rush to her cheeks, felt the courtroom stir and murmur around her, but she did not look away from the barrister's narrowed eyes. "I have loved him," she said, "since before I had any hope of being his wife. I loved him when he married another woman. I loved him when I stood at that wedding and watched him take vows that broke my heart. I loved him when I had nothing, and I love him now. That is not a motive for perjury, sir. It is simply the truth." The courtroom was silent. The barrister opened his mouth, closed it, and sat down. And from the corner of her eye, Elena saw Alexander rise from his seat, his face ashen, his gray eyes blazing with something she could not name. The Lord Chancellor ruled in their favor the following morning. Lord Montfort's petition was dismissed. Lady Charlotte would remain with her father. The Ashworth estate would be placed under the stewardship of an impartial trustee until its accounts were fully restored, and Lord Montfort himself would face criminal charges for embezzlement and fraud. Elena wept when the barrister brought them the news. She wept with relief, with exhaustion, with a joy so sharp it was almost pain. Alexander caught her in his arms, the first time he had ever held her, and she felt his shoulders shake with silent, shuddering breaths. "You did it," he whispered into her hair. "You saved her, you saved us." "We did it," she corrected, her voice muffled against his chest. "Together." They returned to Thornwood as winter was tightening its grip on the moors, and for a few precious weeks, there was peace. The house was warm and bright, filled with the scent of pine boughs and baking bread and Lottie's laughter echoing through the corridors. Alexander began to emerge from his study more often, to join them at meals, to walk with Alina in the garden while Lottie chased the first snowflakes with delighted shrieks. He did not speak of love. He did not speak of what Alina had confessed in the courtroom. But sometimes, when he looked at her, she saw something stirring in the depths of his gray eyes, something fragile and new, like the first green shoots pushing through winter soil. She held onto that hope, and she waited. The fire began in the east wing, on the coldest night of the year. Alina woke to the smell of smoke and the distant crackle of flames. She was out of bed before she fully understood what was happening, her bare feet slapping against the cold floorboards as she ran for the door. The corridor was filling with smoke, thick and black and choking, and she heard screams from the servants' quarters, the thunder of footsteps, the urgent clanging of the alarm bell. But her only thought, her only coherent thought, was Lottie. The nursery was on the third floor at the far end of the east wing, the wing that was burning. Alina did not hesitate. She pulled her shawl over her mouth and plunged into the smoke. The staircase was a furnace. Flames licked up the walls, devouring the ancient paneling, the portraits, the dust sheets that had covered the furniture for years. Alina kept low, her eyes streaming, her lungs screaming, and climbed, step by agonizing step. The heat was unbearable, a physical force pressing against her, but she did not stop. She could not stop. She reached the nursery door and flung it open. Lottie was standing in her crib, her small face red and tear-streaked, her arms reaching out in terrified silence. Alina snatched her up, wrapping her in the blanket from the crib, and turned to run. The corridor was gone. The floor where she had stood moments before had collapsed, a yawning chasm of flame and smoke and splintered timber separating her from the stairs. She backed into the nursery, clutching Lottie to her chest, and looked desperately toward the window. The drop was 3 stories. The ground below was frozen earth. There was no way out. She sank to her knees, pressing her lips to Lottie's hot forehead, and began to pray. She did not hear him come. The roar of the fire drowned out everything, consumed everything, until there was nothing in the world but heat and smoke and the frantic beat of her own heart. But then strong arms were lifting her. A voice was shouting her name, and she looked up into Alexander's smoke-blackened face. "Hold on to me," he commanded, and his voice was a force of nature, a rock in the chaos. "Hold on and do not let go." He wrapped his coat around her and Lottie, shielding them from the flames, and carried them through the inferno. Alina closed her eyes and buried her face against his chest and clung to him as she had never clung to anything in her life. She did not remember the stairs. She did not remember the great hall, the front door, the cold blast of winter air. She remembered only his arms around her, his voice murmuring her name over and over, his hand cupping her face as she lay on the frozen lawn surrounded by servants and villagers and the roaring, devouring fire. "Alina, Alina, look at me. Are you hurt? Is Lottie?"
"She is safe," Alina choked. "She is safe."
Alexander's face crumpled. He pulled her into his arms, Lottie pressed between them, and held them both as the east wing of Thornwood Hall collapsed in a shower of sparks and embers and ancient, burning stone. "I thought I had lost you," he said, his voice breaking. "When I reached the nursery and you were gone, when I saw the floor had collapsed, I thought..." He could not finish. His arms tightened around her and she felt his tears hot against her smoke-stained cheek. "I cannot lose you, I cannot. You are everything. You are the heart of this house, the heart of me, and I have been such a fool." "Alexander," she lifted her hand and touched his face, smearing soot across his cheekbone. "You came for us. You risked your life." "Because I love you," the words burst from him, raw and ragged and fierce. "I have loved you since I saw you at that wedding, hiding your tears, believing no one would notice. I saw you, Alina. I saw your heart breaking, and it broke mine because I knew even then that I was marrying the wrong woman, that I had made a terrible mistake. And it was too late to do anything but watch you slip away into a life I could not be part of. And when I found you again, I told myself it was duty, convenience, nothing more, but I was lying. I have been lying to myself for months. I love you.
I love you. Eleanor stared at him, her heart too full for words. The fire roared behind them. The night sky was orange with flame. The east wing of her home was crumbling to ash, and she had never been happier in her life. I have loved you since Harrogate, she whispered. Since the quadrille, since you smiled at me and asked about the weather. I have loved you for 4 years, Alexander. I never stopped. He kissed her then in the frozen grass, with their daughter in their arms and their home burning behind them. It was not a gentle kiss. It was desperate and fierce and full of all the years they had lost, all the words they had not spoken, all the love they had buried and denied and hidden away. And when they finally pulled apart, breathless and trembling, Lottie squirmed between them and announced, in a small but indignant voice, "Papa, I am cold." Alexander laughed, a real laugh, the first Eleanor had ever heard from him, bright and surprised and full of light. He scooped Lottie into his arms and reached down to help Eleanor to her feet, and together the three of them walked away from the fire, toward the undamaged west wing, toward the future. Spring. The east wing was rebuilt in the months that followed, stone by stone, beam by beam. With funds provided by the settlement against Lord Montford, and contributions from tenants and villagers, who had come to love the quiet duchess who had saved their estate. Eleanor stood in the garden on a May morning, watching Lottie chase a butterfly through the new-planted roses, and felt the sun warm on her face. The moors were green and gold, larks singing overhead, and the smell of honeysuckle drifted on the breeze. Alexander came up behind her and slipped his arms around her waist, his chin resting on her shoulder. "What are you thinking about?" he murmured. "The wedding," she said, "yours and hers. I was thinking about how I stood there trying so hard not to cry and how I was certain my life had ended." He was silent for a moment. Then he said very quietly, "I watched you all through the ceremony. I could not look away." "I know. I thought you were watching me because you pitied me." "I was watching you," he said, "because you were the only real thing in that church, the only person who felt anything true, and I thought even then that if I could have chosen, if I had been free to choose, I would have chosen you." Eleanor turned in his arms and looked up into his face. The shadows that had haunted his eyes were gone now, replaced by a quiet contentment that made her heart ache with joy. "You are free now," she said. "We both are." He smiled, that rare, luminous smile that she had come to treasure, and bent to kiss her forehead, her cheek, her lips. "I choose you," he said. "Every day for the rest of my life, I choose you, Eleanor." In the garden, Lottie laughed and the lark sang, and the sun rose higher over the moors, and the Duchess of Ashworth, who had once hidden her tears at a wedding and been seen, closed her eyes and let the happiness wash over her, warm and golden and endless as the summer sky. If you enjoyed this story, don't forget to give it a like and subscribe to the channel. Also, let us know in the comments which country you're watching from. Your support means a lot to us. Thank you for watching and see you in the next amazing story.